Hi, everyone. I always laugh because where it says he's amongst the world's best known spokespeople on blah, 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 and people say that. I actually wrote that. So I always think it's funny. Like, first, it's funny that I would say that about myself, and then it's funny to actually hear it reflected back. Anyway, I thought it might be interesting. I hope you don't mind what I'm about to do, because I am ecumenical in my practice. Like, I like to hear about everybody else's practice and try it and whatnot. So I thought I would just tell you a little bit about how we practice in my tradition, which is a Korean Zen tradition. It's called the Kwannon School. It was started by a Korean monk who came over, like a bunch of Asians did in the 70s, to try to fix our country. Still trying, but anyway. It's not unlike what I understand to be your practice, which I understand to be just following the breath. But we add a little something, which is what we call a wadu, which is a great question. So we, in our practice, we also follow our... But is there anybody here who's never meditated at all before? Just making sure. Okay, cool. So we also follow our breath. But as we follow our breath, we pick up this question, what am I? Or what's following the breath? And it's not a question... when you ask that question of yourself, lots of stories come. Oh, I'm a writer, I'm an author, I'm a Zen teacher, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a person. All sorts of thoughts come up about when you ask this question, what am I? But then, just like any other time, you just return to your breath and be honest with yourself that actually, when we say, what am I? The answer is, don't know, before thinking. So really what we're doing is we're not asking, when we hold this question, what am I? We're not asking for a discursive description, mental description of what we are. What we're really saying is, let's pay 100% attention to this moment right here, just as it is to this brown floor, and observe what I am, because I can't define what I am. Don't know. So I just thought if you want to play with that, go ahead. And I get, apparently, this is going to be the highlight of my night. So how long? 20 minutes? 25 minutes? 20? You were really good. Thank you. So, first of all, I don't know about you, but I'm having a little bit of a hard time accepting humanity at the moment. And so I just thought it might be worthwhile to look around the room and remember that people here are not just here for practice, but for something called ikosattva. Is that right, Vivian? Ikosattva? So, ikosattva sangha. So everybody here is here, not just practicing for themselves, but for all beings. So I just thought it might be worthwhile us taking a minute to just like look around the room and remember that. Take each other in. Thanks. I thought I'd give you a very brief introduction of my work and how it is that I came to be invited to sit here. And then I'm going to say a few words. And then Vivian says that there are some questions prepared for me. But I'd also like us just to have a conversation and not worry about being too formal and stuff. First of all, I've been practicing with the Quantum School of Zen for 20 years, and in a very causal way, that practice led me to do a project called No Impact Man, which was in 2007, more or less, a project that I did, in which basically I was concerned about what we were doing to get our fossil fuels, which at that time was the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Concerned about what happened when we burned the fossil fuels, which in the winter of 2006, when I used to live down by Washington Square, which was a bunch of NYU students walking around in shorts and t-shirts in January. So what we did to get the oil, what happened when we burned the oil, and then in between this way of life that all of it was powering, you know, that all of it was for, which, you know, it would be one thing if we were wrecking the place and we were having a party doing it. But I was looking around and felt like we weren't really having a party. I mean, my privileged New York friends who had been to college and many of whom had master's degrees were miserable, working 10, 12, 14 hours a day, never spending time with the people that they loved, not exercising the passions and the talents that they'd acquired and wanted to use in their lives, feeling as though they were, in being loyal to their employers, they were betraying themselves in the world. And that's the privilege, and, you know, taking, you know, the, it's gotten to the point where we're all taking so much Prozac that the Prozac is in the drinking water, right? So I personally wonder whether sometimes it shouldn't be like chlorine, you know, fluoride. We should just put the Prozac in the drinking water and call it quits. But nothing against people that, you know, we're, all of us are depressed sometimes. Nothing against needing an antidepressant. But the point is that the privileged people weren't happy. And then we had a billion people on the planet don't even have access to clean drinking water. So destroying the earth, fighting wars to get the oil, destroying the earth, burning the oil, and then this way of life that it's all powering didn't seem right. So I was a writer and I felt that I wanted to turn my career over. And so I ended up writing this book and making this documentary film called No Impact Man, which was about a year I spent with my family as that it was then comprised here in Manhattan, living as environmentally as possible. And when I say living as environmentally as possible, I don't mean like we were careful to recycle. Like if it required to be recycled, it didn't enter the house in the first place. Or it was what some people call extreme environmentalism, although I think it's only extreme in just juxtaposition to an extremely consumerist society that's completely going off course and not far following our values as human beings. But that's another story. Anyway, so I did that work. And it kind of, sometimes I call it undercover Dharma teaching, because the kind of conversations that we have, that I have as a result of No Impact Man, are not so different from the conversations that I have in a Zen center or a Dharma center, which is, you know, what am I for? What are we for? Are we for flat screen TVs working our rear ends off so we can have extra flat screen TV? Or is there some other deeper reason for walking through this life? Anyway, I thought of some things that I wanted to talk about. I should say, I just wanted to tell you something that I was thinking about on my way over, which was that apparently, you know, Trump is just announced the reversal of the Obama safeguards for transgender people in terms of restrooms and colleges around the country. And anyway, it just strikes me as particularly mean-spirited, and it made me sad, and I cried. at my kitchen table. And I was thinking a lot about violence and how in seeking to stop violence, we sometimes perpetuate violence. And thinking a lot about how Buddhists are particularly well suited to cut that cycle. Anyway, this is my book, No Impact Man, and there's this teaching from the Talmud that's the epigraph of the book, I didn't write it, so I can say I've always really liked it. And it's not my writing; it's out of the Talmud. I'd like to read it. So, our sages taught, a man should not move stones from his ground to public ground. A certain man was moving stones from his ground onto public ground when a pious man found him doing so and said to him, "Fool, why do you move stones from ground which is not yours to ground which is yours?" So do you get that? The story is he's moving stones from his ground onto the public ground. But the sage says to him, "Why are you moving stones from the ground which is not yours to the ground which is yours?" The man laughed at him because, you know, he got it all wrong. Some days later, the man had to sell his field. And when he was walking on that public ground, he stumbled over those stones. He then said, "How well did that pious man say to me, 'Why do you move stones from ground which is not yours to ground which is yours?'" I really like that. I'm ecumenical in my studies. I love when I find things from all the traditions that kind of line up with each other, like Islamic studies, Buddhist studies, Christian studies, when more or less the wisdoms and the technologies turn out to be the same. But to me, this is an incredible teaching about interdependence and karma, right? So karma was, it's like, you know, he caused an effect. You know, he moved this, he thought he was selfish, and he moved, if you like, and he moved, although I don't really like, sucking the words back out. He was deluded. Let's not say selfish. He was deluded or ignorant or did not understand his own nature and took the stones off his ground and put it onto the common ground. And then the sage said to him, "Don't you understand that you don't, more or less, you don't actually, there is no ground that belongs to any of us. That works, that, you know, on all sorts of levels. And so when you put something into the, when you're destroying the common ground, you're destroying your ground. Or when you do violence against, when you either grasp, you know, experience towards you and do violence in that way, or push experience away and do violence in that way, then you're actually putting stones on the common ground. You're trying to take stones off your ground and to put it, I'm trying to take stones off my ground and to put it onto your ground, because I'm deluded thinking that your ground and my ground are separate." So it's at the front of No Impact Man because I really like, to me that kind of is a, it sums up consumerism, you know, as a way of life. Sometimes when one talks about consumerism, I always want to be careful because when you talk about consumerism, always the blame is on us, like on each of us as individuals. Oh, I'm a consumer. I'm bad. I want things. But actually, we're in all parts of a gigantic system. So no one of us is particularly bad for being a consumer, but we are in a system of consumerism, which comprises mostly putting our rocks on the common ground to get a better feeling for ourselves. So I like this story because it tells us something about environmentalism. You know, it tells us something about, like, when we try to feel better for ourselves by damaging something so outside of what they say is ourselves, what we say is ourselves, then we're what's he say? Sherman's a fool. We're a fool, according to this age. Fool, he says, this age says fool. Fool's better than selfish, right? It's foolish. It's foolish. I like to say, enlightenment does not give us the right to judge, it gives us the responsibility to teach. And that's why I don't like to use words like selfish. I'd rather use words like foolish. So I was thinking about it some more. I'm an intersectionalist. I don't think that there's really a way to separate climate problems from race problems from oppression according to sexuality and gender identification. I think they're all kind of part and parcel of the same system of thinking and ways of doing things. So even though this is, what's it called again? Eco-sattva sangha, I don't think that I'm talking about something else when I talk about the transgender ruling that happened today. I was thinking about my place in that whole, in this whole system, and is thinking about, because basically what happened was the Attorney General, what's his name? I've forgotten his name. What's his name? Yeah, Sessions. And what's the name of the education person? DeVos, that's right. I know their names, it's just that when you stick a microphone in front of me, I forget everything. So, you know, they were having a fight about it in Sessions 1, and Trump decided that DeVos should back down. And to me, it felt really mean-spirited. And so, sometimes, the question is, when something appears, how do I deal with it as a Buddhist, as an activist, as a human being, right? And it concerns me that when I'm angry and the stones are in my heart and I see somebody else that I'm blaming for my anger, I want to take the stones out of my heart and I want to put them in their heart. I was thinking about the dynamics, and I don't know, and I'm posing questions here. I'm not claiming to know the answer to this, but somehow or another, they already feel as though they have stones in their hearts that somebody else put there for some reason. That's why people be mean, because they have some pain that they're trying to push away from themselves. They think the stones are on their ground. They cannot put the stones on someone else's ground if they don't have stones on their own ground in the first place. The stones are on their ground, and they want to put it on the common ground and get it off their ground, right? But then now the common ground feels like my ground, and I want to put it back on their ground. The question to me is, how do we cut the process of moving the stones from one ground to the other ground? And that's why it's important to me to be careful about using words like selfish as opposed to deluded, and to want to teach instead of judge, or to listen, even to listen before I start teaching, right? So, at the Buddhist, we had a Buddhist Council meeting. The Buddhist Council of New York had a meeting a couple of weeks ago. It was the Forum on Race and Immigration. And it was really good. I thought to myself, oh, great, a bunch of Buddhists who don't know about race talking about race was what was going to happen. But it wasn't. It was actual, you know, they brought in these experts on immigration and it was great. It was really good. Um, And I've completely lost my train of thought about why I brought that up. What did I say right before I mentioned that? The count, the forum. Does anybody remember?
Cutting the process.
Cutting the process. Yeah, so how do we cut the process? I still don't know why I brought that up, but it doesn't matter. So, for me to cut the I know. So I went to the Buddhist Council meeting, and there was a mom from where was he from, Regina? Do you remember? No, he was from
Pakistan.
No, he wasn't from Pakistan. No? Begins with a B.
Bangladesh.
He was from Bangladesh. And he was on a mission where he was going to different countries giving talks about how, basically what he said was, to love Allah, first you must love humanity. And that was more or less his mission, to go around teaching that, teaching a message of peace, and that Islam was a religion of peace, fundamentally. And afterwards, I posted on Instagram and on Facebook a picture of him and something he said, which was, the only answer to hate is love. And somebody started to, on my Facebook, somebody was really angry about, they were angry about that because they were feeling like, how can we love what's happening? And to move forward in the spirit of love or nonviolence does not mean to accept what's happening. What it means for me, so in my school there we talk about bodhisattva anger, right? Bodhisattva anger, there's a story in our literature where somebody asked our founding teacher Zen Master Sung Song, is anger ever okay? And he said, well, of course, there's bodhisattva anger. Bodhisattva anger is like when you're crossing the street and your child goes to step out into the traffic and you grab the kid and you pull the kid back. Oh, what are you doing? You know, and then it usually comes in a flash. And then it's gone because it's not necessary anymore. And then there's ego-attached anger, which is, and I've told you this 1,000 times, and why are you doing this to me? And right? I have, you've probably experienced. I only say that because my daughter has, for sure. So anger has its place, but what I'm not, if I'm not careful, what I'm doing is I'm pushing away from parts of myself that I don't like. Like, you know, so I've been thinking in terms of immigration, you know, how much of the current, you know, because Obama deported 4 million immigrants a year. So is that, how much have I been complicit in that? And how much am I against Trump honestly because he's just not intellectual enough? Like, it's just because he's not as, you know, he presents as a dumbass, you know, that, or do I really care about immigrants, right? So the question is here about my shadow. So bodhisattva anger is ultimately it's compassion and love. Ego-attached anger is, I don't want to be identified with what you're doing. I liked it better when it was all under the carpet, right? When it wasn't in my face. That's what I'm, you know, and is that what I'm really angry about? That the injustices in this country are all really in my face now, whereas before I could go along pretending they weren't? It's only important because if I can identify where I have bodhisattva anger and where I have ego-attached anger, bodhisattva anger doesn't include me putting stones back in the other person's field, right? That's why it's important for me to understand myself in this regard. Is there a way for me to stop the movement of the stones You know, so I don't know if you're familiar with George Orwell's Animal Farm, where the pigs led the animals in the revolt against the farmers. But when the revolution was over, the pigs started walking on 2 feet and moved into the farmhouse. And the animals said, "I thought you said all animals are equal." And the pigs said, "Yes, but some animals are more equal than others." And it recreated the system. So I feel as though we as Buddhists, because we understand karma, we understand cutting off stories and returning to not knowing over and over and over again, right? So we can cut off the stories about enemies and bad people and horrible and just act out of love and compassion. Doesn't mean we accept their actions. Doesn't mean we don't stop their actions, sometimes maybe even with a fair amount of force. But we're conscious. We remain conscious of how we act. I just want to say, so I'm in both worlds. I'm in the activist world and I'm in the Buddhist world. And there's, you know, two things that I've wanted to see, that I've hoped to see. One is the Buddhists picking up the technology, the technologies of the activists. That is to say, understanding that we come to practice for our own personal pain, which most of us, you know, usually something has hurt us, or we have a big question about life, like why, you know, we have some big question about life and it's led us to inquire through practice, you know, to hopefully move away from our own personal suffering. Most of us, when our practice is digested enough, recognize that even if we stop perturbing the pond, even if we stop making ripples, as long as other people continue to make ripples, the surface is going to be agitated. So there's no nirvana for one person. We enter nirvana together, right? And then the next question becomes, well, how do we enter, how do we help everybody else so that we can enter nirvana together? And one way is teaching meditation. But I always often think about the realms of existence, and as you know, there are the God realms, and where we're so, where we have so much power that we're able to seduce ourselves into thinking that by pulling the various materialistic levers, we'll get what we really need, and so we're seduced away from inquiry and enlightenment. Or the hell realms, where we're just suffering so much that we can't possibly take the time to practice and inquire after ourselves, right? So I like this conceit because what it tells me is that if all of humanity is to become enlightened, then somehow they, and you also know that it's said that enlightenment can only be achieved in the human realm, right? Well, the human realm, metaphorically speaking to me, just means the realm in which we are not seduced so much by our luxuries that we don't bother to sit, or distracted by so much by our suffering that we don't bother to sit. The human realm is where we have just enough luxury and just enough suffering to actually make us think, I better sit, or I better inquire after my humanity and ask, what am I, right? And gain some peace. So the question becomes, the question is, how do we help people get to the human realm? And when there's so much injustice and so much even lack of food, and there is climate disaster, and there's incredible wealth, how do we help people actually first get onto the mat? How do we help people get into the human realm? So that means that we may be called to use activist technologies as well as Buddhist technologies. The second thing that I've been hoping to see is Buddhists sharing contemplative technologies with activists, so that the activists can learn what I've just said about the stones and also can learn to take care of themselves. Always the story of what happened to Buddha, we always tell the story, which is, and then he saw the star, right? But that was just boom, right? And then Buddha spent years and years of his life as a minister, teaching.
to me, it strikes me that to be a Buddhist is actually to be a minister, right? So what do we have to minister to this suffering world? What do we have to minister to the activists? How do we minister as activists? How do we minister to those we feel are deluded or ignorant? That's those. And I don't claim to know the answer to those questions. Because it's not, there's no answer that there are one, I mean, and how, also on top of all of that, how do we gain peace for ourselves? And I would argue that in part, gaining peace for ourselves is answering those questions for ourselves too. So those were all the things I wanted to just, I thought I would say before Vivian asked me her questions. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thanks.
So we came with a few questions because we weren't sure if you were planning on presenting, but I was just thinking of sharing a couple of the questions that we came up with and then opening it to the rest of the participants here to do a Q&A. And the first question that I want to bring up is about the rolling retreat. So Regina, who is here today with us, is the organizer, and she has organized the Three Jewel Rolling Retreat. And she has three buses going to D.C. on April 29th to attend the People's Climate March. And I would like to invite you to speak a little more about it a little later. But I was just wondering, as a teacher who will be one of the teachers at the retreat, what do you see for you is the importance of joining this march and being involved in this action? Oh.
Yeah, do marches even count or matter? I mean, marches ultimately are sangha. You know, it's one of the three jewels to come together. Marches do a bunch of things. They get covered by the press, right? So they cause conversation. They bring us together just like Sangha and feel like other people care about the things that we do. They allow, it's like chanting. You know, in my tradition, we chant Kwansum Bosal. Kwansum Bosal is the Korean name for Kualin, so the Bodhisattva of compassion. So people say sometimes, well, what does chanting Kwansum Bosal? I thought we'd do some Kwansum Bosal chanting before I go too. Why does chanting matter? Because, you know, so it's chanting is an expression of compassion. It's lubricating and bringing out the compassion in each of us so that when we go out into the world, we can continue. So that's marching. But it also, the other thing about marches is that it lends power to the leaders, right? So that when things are happening in the halls of Congress or whatnot, people are saying, you know, and somebody marches into a congressperson's or a senator's office, the senator knows, or the congressperson or whomever knows that there's actually massive support for what the person's saying, right? So then maybe something happens on a, maybe something happens on a mystical level, who knows, also when people come together. Does anybody else have any things, reasons why marches are important that I haven't mentioned? Yeah. Okay. But I mean, people, like after the Women's March, people have been massively, it's really attracted a lot of attention. It's made people want to do stuff, right? So the same thing with it. And that's similarly, there was a lot of activism after the People's Climate March and whatnot. So.
Thank you. And Regina, would you like to come up here and share some more details about the Rolling Retreat?
But I also just want to say, no, go ahead. You go ahead. But I'll just say also, I don't think it does any harm for Americans to express to the rest of the world that we actually care about it, even if our government is not telling the rest of the world. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So yes, as Vivian mentioned, we are having the rolling retreat on the 29th, and everyone here is invited to join. Please do if you can. We are going to, it's a retreat on a bus on the way to DC. So we're going to have a lot of teachers. It's going to be amazing. We're going to have Bhikkhu Bodhi as a teacher. We're going to have Colin, as you know, as a teacher, and also Roshi Inkyo O'Hara of the Village Zendo. And more will be added to the list. So the idea is to have Dharma teachings and meditation on the way to DC so that we can engage in this action with compassion in mind, rather than, like, as Colin said, moving stones from, you know, our yard to someone else's, acting not with anger, but with, what was the anger? The bodhisattva anger.
Bodhisattva anger.
We're going to be, you know, marching with bodhisattva anger. So there's a website where you can purchase passes for the retreat, and it's compassionnyc.org, and the prices are on a sliding scale. And if you have any questions, you can certainly ask. And also, I think it's really important, like you asked, Colin, why it's important to participate in this. I think it's also important to participate, to have a Buddhist showing there. The Green Faith has been really organized, 350.org, in garnering a lot of the faith-based coalitions. And we, you know, we always see a lot of Christians. We see a lot of Jewish organizations. We don't really see a lot of Buddhist representation. So I thought it was really important to make sure that our voices and presence was heard and seen, so that people can know that, yeah, we don't just have compassion for ourselves. We don't just, you know, sit on a cushion in a meditation hall and that's where our practice begins and ends. It actually spreads outward, and to me, that's when, once we get off the cushion, that's where the practice begins. Like, the cushion prepares us for practice, and then once we step off the mat, that's where the practice begins. Thanks.
Thank you, Regina. So I'd like to open up the space for any questions that the audience has for Colin.
Or comments, you know.
Or comments.
Speaking of, are there guided meditations that you found useful in to help people when they're preparing for an action which may involve their arrest?
I've never led a guided meditation in before an arrest. But I'll tell you something from our own practice style that I find really helpful. So maybe we'll just do it too. So you're going to think I'm not answering your question, but I'm coming to it. I want to tell another story from the Jewish tradition, which is the story of Rabbi Zusia, who was in Poland in the 18th century. He was a teacher. He was a Hasidic. And he didn't show up to teach his students one day, and then not the next day. And they came to his... eventually they ran to his house, because the only reason why he wouldn't show up is because he was sick. And they found him there, and he was actually on his deathbed. And he was really agitated and upset. They said, "Why are you upset, Rabbi? You've always taught us that to die is natural, so we shouldn't be upset about it, but you're very upset." And he said, "Oh, I'm not upset about dying. I'm upset about meeting God. What will I say when God holds me accountable?" And they said, "But you've been more obedient than Abraham and more faithful than Moses." And he said, "Oh, I'm not afraid if God asks me why wasn't I more like Abraham. And I'm not afraid because I'll just say because I'm not Abraham. And if God asks me why wasn't I more like Moses, I'll say because I'm not Moses. I'm frightened if God asks me, why weren't you more like Zusia?" So this is really, I love this story a lot. It's in my book, How to Be Alive, because it points to something that we're actually, there's something about becoming ourselves that we're supposed to do, like that's part of life, and something about living according to our values, and something about actually returning to not knowing before our stories and allowing from that place of not knowing our true selves to arise, right? And for most of us, from that place of true self is gigantic compassion, right? So, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Magnolia. I'm dating myself a little, but it's a great movie. But there's this one character, and he's obsessed with getting braces. He thinks that if he gets braces, he'll be loved. And so he asks his employer for a loan to get these braces, and the employer says no. So he actually tries to break into his employer's store to steal the cash to get the braces, and he's climbing up the drain pipe by the side of the building to get into the store, and it starts to rain frogs. It's one of the seven plagues, right? And it starts to rain frogs, and one of these gigantic bullfrogs hits him on the head, knocks him on the ground. He hits the ground face first and comes up with all his teeth knocked out and a bloody mouth. So much for braces, right? And he says, he's crying, and he says, "I have so much love inside me. I just don't know where to put it." So that's kind of like, why not be more like Zusia, not being more like Zusia. Like, where do we put our love? So many of us want us to do that. So Kwantzen Bosal chanting is like, it's like holding this question, how can I help? How can I help? How can I help? How can I help? At all times, people, because that's one of the things that I teach a lot about, finding your purpose, finding your place in life, finding your ministry, finding your calling. And so people will say to me, what's a practice that I can hold? And because they're, most of them aren't Buddhists, and you know, they don't want to hear about the Buddhist saint of compassion called Kwantzen Bosal, which anyway, most people know is, even if they know about it, they know as Kuan-Lin from Chinese Buddhism, not Korean Buddhism, so they really don't want to go through all of that. So instead what I say, just hold at all moments this question, how may I help? How may I help? How may I help, right? On the subway platform, like a mantra, how may I help? But with a deep inquiry, right? With holding the inquiry at all times. And if you hold the inquiry, then it will move you towards helping, right? So that's a practice for all times, including marches and including when you're about to get rested. How can I help? How can I help? How can I help? But let's us do it the way we do it in Korean Buddhism. Can we chant for a minute? Is that all right? All right, let's stand up. So I actually brought the mok ta. So if I was in my sangha and somebody asked me your question, I'd just say, hold Kwantzen Bosal, rather than how can I help, right? Because it's the same thing. So Kwantzen Bosal is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And we chant the name Kwantzen Bosal to send compassionate energy. Wait, we say it. We're basically we're saying Kwantzen Bosal, like go wherever. And when you're Kwantzen Bosal chant, you can hold a sick person, you can hold transgender people who are facing the new Trump order, you can hold the climate, you can hold whatever you want. If you keep doing it for a while, then the kind of barriers between your separate thoughts start to break down, and the spirit of Kwantzen Bosal actually pervades everything. And you find yourself, actually, you might all of a sudden get an image of a troubled politician you don't particularly like with a bad hairdo in your head while you're saying Kwantzen Bosal. Is Kwantzen Bosal, that troubled politician needs Kwantzen Bosal, right? And the amazing thing is, this is the thing that I think is miraculous, is that if you're sending Kwantzen Bosal energy into the world with all your heart at any particular moment, you've actually become Kwantzen Bosal. And then there's nothing that isn't quantum bosal in that moment. So it goes, I'll say it by myself for a minute and then you can just follow me. It goes, Quan Sam Bo Sal, 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 Quan Sam Bo Sal. Really interesting, you'll follow me, but really interesting because to chant Quan Sam Bo Sal requires deep listening, right? So that's why Avalokiteshvara, Quan Sam Bo Sal also, has 1,000 eyes and 1,000 hands to see the suffering and then help it, to hear the suffering and then help it. So to chant together, we have to also listen. So, virtual bow. Can do that for a really long time. It doesn't really matter the word or the name, but holding the intention and the spirit. So you can say Mother Mary. How does the rosary go? Mother Mary, does anybody know?
Hail Mary, full of grace.
Hail Mary, full of grace. Also,
Hail Mary, full of grace. Hail Mary, full of grace. Hail.
Doesn't matter. It all has to do with your commitment. So I'm not oppressing you with my Zen tradition by telling you Quan Sam Bo Sal. It doesn't matter the words you say. It matters that you, the spirit that you say with the words, and that you hold them, and that you hold the compassionate, service-oriented intention. Anyway, that was fun for me. How is it for you? Any other questions? Oh, wow. Here, we'll start with you and then we'll...
Hi, Colin. I was just wondering, how did you find this particular tradition and what drew you to it? Because it's, to be quite honest, it's not one that I'd heard of. I mean, Zen, yes, but not this particular branch.
Yeah, so we're pretty quiet. It's paradoxically, we're actually one of the biggest westernized Zen organizations actually in the world. We have 92 Zen centers and sitting groups. We're quiet. There are not very many writers or public speakers, in the school. I found them because I was at the time about 20 years ago living in Providence, Rhode Island, and our head temple is in Cumberland, Rhode Island, right outside Providence. It's called the Providence Zen Center, even though it's in Cumberland. And it's a beautiful, there's a monastery, it's beautiful. It's on 40 acres. It's in the woods. But anyway, I was living in Providence. And I was talking to somebody. I was saying that I was interested in meditation. They said, "Oh, you should go to hear Zen Master Sees, participate in Zen Master Sung Song's thing." And I was like, "Well, tell me about it." And he said, "Well, he says you must wash your mind with don't know soap. And I thought, I really like that. And then I also heard this one. This body, just rental car. Big question. Who drives rental car? I realized it's just like corny. So corny. Like an advertising person's version of Zen or something. And then when I, why I went, and what I really liked is because I had been studying texts through my 20s, and at that time, doctrinal work didn't work with me because I didn't want to hear what they said. I wanted to have what they had. No matter whether it was Meister Eckhart or Buddha or Jesus or whoever it was, I just didn't believe that there was. I wanted to not just study their words. So in Zen, there's really. Oh, and also, I had always had this question of feeling as though, where's the owner's manual? Like, what, just tell me when I'll do it. Just tell me what it is I'm supposed to be doing. Like, what am I supposed to be doing in this life, you know? And so they say that Zen is about understanding yourself. That's why you have this, what am I? So I like that. And I liked also that the teachers just don't tell you shit. You know, that, I mean, they say stuff. Of course they do. We have all sorts of stories and of the patriarchs and stuff like that. But it's all, our practice is always just the same as here. I'm sure it's always pointing back towards yourself and finding, you know, finding out for yourself that the cushion is red and the floor is brown and the wall is white. And, yeah. And by the way, did you notice that your white shirt and your sweater and yours too actually match the cushions? Oh. I just noticed that while I was going. And your shirt too over there. There's a lot of burgundy in the room. Somebody, you had your hand raised.
I think it's more of a comment. I actually didn't know what tonight's topic was, but I wanted to come because I've just been so unsettled. Mm. I needed to meditate. My sister and I also go to the SGI Channing Temple, which is great. But I enjoy both meditating. But my thoughts in my mind has just been, for the past week, really anxious with a lot of anticipation. And things are resolving and turning around, but yet I still feel unsettled. So I wanted to sit quietly. The topic that we are discussing today is, of course, something that's very important to me. I'm not an activist, but I believe in it. You like when you say that it gets the media talking. I just don't like crowds. Yeah. And I also have reasons. I grew up with a big family. I have 9 siblings. And I did a lot of taking care of a lot of people. Mm. And I noticed when people in society, they're marching and they take on roles that are a lot of caretaking. If you talk to a lot of them, they had more of a solitude upbringing, where for me it was such opposite. I helped so much that it's not that I don't want to help, it's built in. Mm. And also I'd rather help anonymously. But I think for me, when you talked about this person carrying their stones, I have been in a very toxic living situation with the individual that rents a nearby quarter to mine, and it's extremely toxic for me. And today the landlord offered to move me to the front, away from this person, which resolves that. But there's just a residue right now, I feel, of just kind of settling down and being with the isness. I think that when I'm antagonized, it seems like because I am of peace and a peaceful person, and people that can't be at peace. They want to antagonize. They want to see if they can get a rise out of you. And so what I do is, I don't know, I don't have any feelings as if I just want them to go away and leave me alone, leave me in peace. That's as far as like what I want you to do is leave me alone. So I don't react. I yield. Unless it's something that's jeopardizing my rights. For example, this person said, I'm not going to use the kitchen. You can't do that. I'm paying to use the kitchen. But if you're just doing things because you have all of these stones, I will not react to that. So I don't know if I'm... I think basically what you're saying and what we're talking about here is a mass amount of people, but it still is, as we looked around the room at individuals. And I think I'm able to do that. I heard someone say, when you go in a hospital, are you mad at the people because they're sick? So why would you be mad at people because they're sick? And so I'm not mad at the person. I just would. I don't want toxic around me. So for me personally, I just want to be left alone. That's my posture. So I don't know. I just felt like saying that. Thanks.
Thank you. You made me think of something. It's not a comment on what you said, but it is something that I think is important to say in this, as part of this conversation, is that there are many ways to help the world. And activist is... So I personally, I'm an activist, but I'm also actually... I write and speak and minister, if you like, to activists. And don't... I'm not an organizer, for example, like... That's what I think of as real activism, not just going on the march, but being an organizer, and I'm not. But my point is that it's like the Sushia story. Like, we're called to find who we are and to use that who we are in service of the world, right? I would argue that we're also, in Buddhist circles, I don't know if you guys have this saying, but... when a hungry man comes, what? Feed him. When a thirsty woman comes, what? Okay, so, but sometimes in our teaching, at least in my tradition, it's very passive. So you just kind of sit there and wait around for a hungry person to come. Or you kind of sit there and wait around for somebody thirsty to come. Or you actually don't acknowledge that there's a system that's making people hungry and making people thirsty. So I would argue that we are called to understand. Do you ever hear about the fish who turns to the other fish and says, how's the water? And the other fish says, what water? And it's the same that with the civic systems that we live in, we don't even realize, for example, that we're in a consumerist system. I would argue that we're called upon to start to understand the systems, the political systems, the religious systems, the civic systems, the racist systems, all the systems in which we're living, to help us understand how we're called to help, right? Rather than just waiting for the hungry person to come and the thirsty woman to come.
Hi, Colin. Hi. Thanks for being here. Unfortunately, I can't, because I'm leading a retreat that weekend somewhere else, I can't go on the march, on the buses and on the march. But it reminded me, and both what you just said and also what this gentleman, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, just Eugene said, and it's something I've said in teaching, is that we forget that meditation is a very radical action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even being on retreat or even just being here not doing is a radical action. And that if, you know, I joke, you know, like if 25% of the world went on retreat for 3 months of the year, and it just, you know, that would be kind of remarkable, because just the consuming would stop for those 25% of the people. But even while we're here, we're not consuming. We're breathing, but we're not consuming. And we just have to remind ourselves that sometime. Because not only does it nourish us to be here, which makes it easier to be out there, But just being here is radical. And I think that's really important to remind ourselves. And it's not an excuse. It's just, you know, it's a fact, I think.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And I like to say spiritual activism and active spirituality, right? Like the two things that well, it's hard to minister if you haven't ministered to yourself, you know? And it's hard to minister if you also don't actually, if you haven't come to an understanding of your relationship to the world, because how can you change the world without having an understanding of your, yeah. Was there any other questions? Hi.
Thank you. I just started reading your No Impact Mandana halfway through. Many of us in the Ekosava Sangha is pretty new to kind of really what's our personal practice to live a more eco-friendly life. And my question is, when we go out into the world and encounter the culture, for example, just kind of like, you know, for me, water is pretty acceptable these days in reusable, but like if you want to bring your own container to a restaurant and say, I want to, you know, have takeout in that, I think literally people would still put it in a plastic and then, like, because it's just so inconvenient. So how do you talk to people who are not in the same mind frame in a day-to-day life, but without being condescending, without being angry all the time? It's just kind of like, how do you wove your own practice into it?
This is a constant question that how do we talk to other people? How do I talk to people about, you know, how do we talk to Trump supporters? You know, the question is constant. One time I was at the farmer's market, and somebody had seen the movie No Impact Man, and I was at the Union Square Farmer's Market. And this woman said, "You're No Impact Man." She said, "Wait here." She disappears into the crowd. A moment later, she comes back out through the crowd, dragging this man, who was, I guess, her husband, because who else would have accepted it? And then she drags him over to me. She goes, "Tell him." Yeah, you get it. It's like so. There's actually, I think, a market for eco-marriage therapist. So that's not one way not to. There was a moment when, before I did No Impact Man, where at first, when I decided to write about climate and the things that I mentioned at the beginning, I wanted to write a book about how all you people, you should stop driving your SUVs and running your air conditioners and blah, 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 you know. And my agent said to me, my literary agent, "Everything you're saying is true, but who wants to pay $29.95 to read that shit?" And we had just had that conversation. And I came home, it was a hot August day, and it was sweltering, in the corridor of my apartment building, but when I opened the door to my apartment, this frigid cool air washed out over me. And that's because I had left both air conditioners on all day long so that it would be cool when I got home, because it's too much to have to wait 15 minutes for your apartment to cool down, right? And in that moment, I actually thought, wait, we're at war for oil, for energy. So over 3,000 American soldiers and over 100,000 Iraqis have died for energy, and I'm leaving my air conditioner on all day long, wasting it. So the energy literally equates to dead people. What does that say about me? And then my attitude changed, and I had an understanding But I didn't earn the understanding. Just like when we don't earn a place on the mat either. We're graced with it. I was graced with the understanding. I fell into it. So first of all, it's really important to understand that, to have that understanding that I was graced with, you know, an enlightenment experience or an understanding. I didn't earn it. So it doesn't make me better than anybody else. It means that I was in the right place at the right time, and the other person that I'm talking to was not. And if I'm lucky, this might be their right place and right time. So that's an important thing to me to remember. First of all, it changes my attitude and my approach. Second is who we're talking to, like the audience we're choosing. A lot of times I give talks at colleges, and college students talk about how their parents won't listen to them, and they tell their parents to recycle, and their parents won't recycle. They'll say it doesn't really matter. So it's always interesting to me in the story of Jesus Christ that when he went back to his own town, he was incapable of working miracles because everybody just said, "You're the carpenter's son, right?" Right? The same thing. We can't teach our families, our parents. But the bigger thing is to choose your audience. You know, the Zen Master Sung Song, who founded my school, he would give talks and answer questions, and he would very patiently listen to people. And they'd ask a question, he would give an answer. Sometimes there would be an argumentative answer thing back. He would give another answer, and a little bit more argument. And then finally he would say, "There's no point giving acupuncture to a dead cow." Right? So don't try to give acupuncture to dead cows. Look for the biggest thing is that there are people who just right then they don't have the time. They can't hear you right then. And so respect that and wait for the person who can hear you. And then when you're looking for a person who can hear you, how they'll be able to hear you is not by me, not by me saying, "You should agree with all my values and live according to my values and let me tell you why." But let me understand your values and explain to you how doing this will actually help you to fulfill your values. Right? So, and let's say climate change. I can shove climate science down someone's throat, but if what they care about is job creation, the climate science is not going to help. They want to know about job creation. So instead, I can tell them about statistics that shows that renewable energy creates more jobs than fossil fuel. And in fact, there was just a story about how the oil fields in Texas are recovering from the slump because of the decline in oil prices. They're recovering, but the jobs are not recovering. So the oil industry is making money again, but people are not having jobs. So I often say that it begins by listening, basically. So this is the same as Quan Symposal chanting. You know, here Quan, in our Quanum, so Quanum means hear sound. That's the name of our school. Hear world sound. Quan Sayam, hear world sound. Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva who hears world sound and then acts. Is that helpful? Yeah. Any other questions or comments or thoughts? Yeah, hi.
We had been speaking in previous weeks here about how it would be good for us to get in contact with people from other Buddhist sanghas like you. It's really good. We were having this rolling refuge on the way down to Washington, but it would be good to keep it going with both you and other people from other sanghas. Yeah. Because we got a long road to hoe.
Yeah, I'm hoping, I haven't announced it to my Sangha, but we're hoping that some people from my Sangha will come and also. And yeah, I completely, the same as this Buddhist forum that I mentioned, which is the Buddhist Council, is representatives from all the sanghas, or many of the sanghas in New York, coming together. And yeah, how do we form? It's something that we were talking about in my sangha, and clearly you're talking about it too. Like, how do we form community with other Buddhists and share? Also, in my particular New York temple, but in our whole school, the Quantum School in the 92 cities, one of the things that we're grappling with is in diversity and inclusiveness. And so each sangha is recreating the, what do you call it? Reinventing the wheel. How do we actually come together as one sangha, one wider North American sangha, and learn to deal with the issues around, well, not just race, but race and gender and sexuality and all of that kind of stuff.
So I'm wondering whether the work that you have done with No Impact Living has found its way into your sangha. I'm wondering, in terms of when you're referring about institutionalizing, then how do we institutionalize solutions in the same way? And part of what our group is hoping and toying with and looking into and researching is, how do we bring these values into centers such as this? And we're in very early stages, but it is a good conversation to have and looking into. And I'm just wondering if there is something that you can share with us on that.
First of all, it made me laugh because you said that has it found its way into the Zen Center. And so it's, first of all, there are these institutional problems. So we, in our Zen Center, we have two residents. So one of the residents just didn't, it was hard, the Sangha wanted to do certain stuff, but this resident was resistant, blah, blah, blah. So there's the politics. But the funny thing is that whilst the No Impact stuff has found its way in a limited way into the Sangha and the Zen Center, it's found its way into the Zen Master's family. So they're always saying to him, "What would Colin say?" It's really funny. I think to figure it out as a sangha and around the Zen Center just means, like, a group of people sit down and look around the Zen Center, you know, look at the trash can, look at the lights, look at the this, look at the that, and look at, you know, look at all the, look at what's being bought, you know, when we come down to what we're really talking about is an inventory of our relationships to the world, right? So that can be in terms of the products that you use and the electricity that you use and all of that. And it also, we then, you know, like I was mentioning, diversity and inclusion. So it also asks us, how are we relating to communities, to different communities that comprise our city? How are, you know, so we can inventory all the relationships. Sometimes I feel as though it can get a bit, stark sounding, like, how do we inventory our relationships and make, but one of the things that I like to point out is that, so let's say in the case of food, right, that's one of the ways that we relate to the world, right? And one way to relate to the world through food is to go in the grocery store and concern yourself with which of the agricultural giants is trying to rip you off or not being careful in terms of the safety of the food, and you kind of walk through the grocery store and you basically are hoping to get out as cheaply as you can with the best tasting food, wondering if it's really good for you, and et cetera, et cetera. That's one way. But another way to relate to food is, if you can, to, you know, you find yourself at the farmer's market and you have a relationship with the farmer. And when you turn, like, I don't know about you guys, but oftentimes at the farmer's market, I buy an apple and it's 86 cents. And I just say to the farmer, oh, just keep it. And partly it's because, like, who wants to carry around a dime and four pennies? Yes. But it's partly because, it's also because the 14 extra cents is going to somebody who's actually taking care of the land. And if it's a farm where they have animals, taking good care of the animals, they actually want to care about their food and that the food is good for the people that they sell it to. So that's a different kind. So all of a sudden my relationship to the world through food is a different kind of relationship, where I don't just get what I need to keep myself alive, I don't just get security, but I also get meaning and purpose through that relationship, right? So so another idea is how we transport ourselves. You can transport yourself in a metal box, and or you can use your body. So then if you use your body, not only do you, they say bicyclists are the happiest commuters, because you're, all sorts of reasons, you're relating to your environment in a whole different way. So it's a full relationship, right? So I'm just saying this so that instead of it being like this, oh, we have to be careful not to use paper plates, and oh, blah, 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 that actually if we can create our relationships, if we look carefully at the relationships we have to the world, it's not just about, just in the same way that the precepts are not just about ethical living, but they're actually a path to our own salvation because it provides peace in our mind. So do these relationships not just are about being ethical, but actually have the potential to create a more joyous, fuller relationship with the world at large. Can I do a little self-advertising? Is that what that? Okay. All right, if I could just remember what I wanted to advertise. Oh, two things. One thing is that I sometimes go to people's homes and give talks and stuff like this. And so sometimes people invite me to do that and they pay me in some way, or people contribute or something. And so I just want to say that I'm open to invitations like that. If you would like me to share the types of things that I talk about with your friends or... and the other thing is that at the moment I'm enrolling, I have two spots left in what I call the How to Be Alive Mastermind group. And it's a group that meets once a week. We meet by video conferencing, and everybody that's part of the group are people who are trying to figure out how to bring their lives in line with their values. A lot of people are, you know, and for many of the people in this group, it's around career, like how do they make their, and what makes it different. So it's, and what, how the group works is that we share, we help each other refine our visions, our strategy, and then the manifestation of the strategy. So we hold each other accountable. We help each other brainstorm. And this type of thing. What's different? I don't know if you've heard of other mastermind groups. What's different about this mastermind group is that everybody that's part of this group is people who are wanting to live a life that has a meaningful impact on the world.
Can I take one of the spots?
You can. What I should say is that it's paid for. It's not free, but I can send you information about it. Yeah. Yes, you can definitely take one of the slots. There's only two slots left, and there are going to be 10 people. And what we do, we meet once a week for 90 minutes for 6 months. So, yeah, I'll send you information. Yeah. If anybody else wants information, just give me your email address, and I'll send it to you. One more little advertisement. If you want to be on my email list, it's really simple, colinbevin.com/join. colinbevin.com/join, and you can go on my email list. Any other questions or comments? Maybe we're done. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.com. www.mindfulnessmeditation.org/donate.